But the same token, let's talk about why metro areas are getting more development than rural areas. How come we don't have the adequate amount of transport to commute people by train to town? And a good example is, so you have Chicago, and here's Rockford. It's not a rural town. It's the fourth largest town in Illinois, but they have 22 unemployment rate. There's no train. This takes 90 minutes from here to here. There's no train. But Chicago just got a digital manufacturing plant. And the question was, how come it's not in Rockford? Because they cannot show they can have that kind of business. And I hate saying this, but all this is built in obsolescence. Republicans and Democrats do this, in my view, on purpose to show you invest money in here, not here. Mm. And people will travel hours all the way to like Chicago or LA or elsewhere, and then buy local back home and everything.
Yeah, and actually that used to be the reverse. They were going to the smaller areas because it was cheaper, but then because people in the city complained and they got more funding, and so now that, what you were just talking about, the jobs went to the bigger city because they're getting funding because they were complaining.
Right.
And the smaller cities, they don't. It's like almost, it's funny because all of these problems encounter like my own county in Fresno County, and just half of it on the poorer side of it.
Yeah.
Which is predominantly rural, although it wasn't shown up on the map there. It was empty.
So let me throw this other
okay.
case study, and you guys can reflect on this one. So there's one town in Illinois called Pontiac. It's a very small town. I mean, this building is the size of Pontiac, no joke. Their only employment is the prison. A few years ago, they wanted to get rid of the prison. So a whole bunch of activists, including myself, said, decarcerate, no more, we can't do this right. We cannot have this. Someone came up to me and goes, if you get rid of the prison, we have nothing. So that puts us in a quagmire, right? We're trying to advocate for something really real, really systemic. But this is their only source of employment. How do you deal with that?
Help them find other employment. Bring in other types of businesses. Renewable
energy. Right.
Or...
right. I mean, these are the kind of things that we have to really think about, because as activists, as organizers, as political strategists, like, sometimes we're so stuck in our campaigns that sometimes we do forget about the other side of that, right? And it's like, you know, what do you do? Because I do want to decarcerate in a situation like that. But if this person has traveled to Bloomington, Illinois, who might get a job at State Farm, maybe. I mean, I don't know. But I mean, this is something to think about, yes.
What about reinvigorating the local farmers?
Well, that's always been a conversation, and what there's always been this movement to get farmers to move away of buying into Monsanto, Tyson, things like that, because Vice News did this. They followed a small farmer who did chickens, and he said if Tyson didn't come in, we would have been done in 2 years. But Tyson doesn't give them crap, right? It wasn't enough for new equipment, a salary, their home, but they had to rely on Monsanto, Tyson, elsewhere, as well as the government. I mean, there's farmers next to me who, on their taxes, will deem themselves a poor farmer, but they live in a three-bedroom house. Because the IRS, you know, you can only take so much money. You can claim so much money, you know? And they said, well, the government also subsidized for us, so it's like their welfare. And it's like one of those other questions of, it's good health care, it's good welfare, but at the same token, you know, how are you helping a situation out? So we should invigorate farming, but how can we do it not only in an alternative way, but in a more future-focused way, so that we can have the kind of crops and
co-ops.
That'd be great. Purchasing co-ops, worker co-ops, stuff like that, yes.
Well, you know, there is a plank national platform for farm parity pricing.
Yeah, there is.
And that would reinvigorate the family farmer, definitely.
The other issues, and I could do a whole day on pretty much rural sociology on this. Public health care and substance abuse, if you're in my last workshop, you would hear me on this big tirade about that. So the Cliff Note version is, it's a problem. It's a huge problem. Opioids in the rural areas is a problem. Meth is a big problem. Cocaine's a big problem because drug trafficking, they know their market. They know who to hit up in this area. And there are people who live in town like, there's no, if you live in a small town like I did in the 80s and 90s, what do you do in a small town?
Drunk on Saturday night.
Right? For us, you went to the punk show, you got high, you drank, you went to church, and you went to work the next day. That's all you did.
Yeah.
Right? So public health and substance abuse is a huge issue. Like some areas like don't even know, like their county health department supplies condoms for them. And they're just sitting there, you know? And they also don't do that other job of like advocating for education, you know? So if you live in a town that's very abstinent focused, but we have these contraceptives to help you out. And when you have, there's big assault on Planned Parenthood, who takes out every single Planned Parenthood clinic in rural areas, and you have to rely on, like where I live, the Emma Goldman Clinic in Iowa City, which is like a 2-hour drive just to get checked up. It's a real problem. Immigration is an issue in rural areas, or migrant workers come to rural areas. Where I live, we have migrant workers from Mexico. I see them. I have lunch with them every Tuesday, you know, but we have ICE in town. You know, I know for a fact 100 people are missing in my town. You know, education, always a problem in education. When I say education is a problem, not enough funding for public education. And in places like Illinois, Iowa, and Wisconsin, I think in Wisconsin, like they advocate for like voucher programs and as well as vouching for charter schools as well as private schools, which is a problem in itself. So you have like some public schools that will utilize like AP testing as a way to say, this is the only way you're going to get out of small town USA is by taking AP from freshman year to senior year so you can go to Harvard or MIT or University of Illinois or University of Iowa or Berkeley, you know, but you need funding for AP testing because it's like $100 a whack per test. Food, I'll guarantee you every rural area is a food desert. I mean, the nearest grocery store is going to be 45 minutes away, maybe half hour, and it's going to be Kroger or the Piggly Wiggly. I love Piggly Wiggly. You might have Hy-Vee, and this is a great opportunity as organizers and campaigning to have a farmer's market if you don't have one, starting a food co-op, starting something. The local ecology, it sucks because rural area means rural development, which means we need more agricultural land, we need to build up town, which means we have to get rid of this 100-acre woods so we can put the mall in, or move, we have to build up the swamp area so this one area can be mostly affluent. We do a poor job of protecting our local ecology, you know, and especially like where I live, where you're close to the Mississippi River, you know, like that's a problem, you know. Any questions about any of the issues? You and then you.
Well, I was, you know, one thing that I'm seeing in my hometown, I live in Mainz, which is mostly rural, but I live in Portland, which is the most populous city.
Yeah.
But we have a problem with, I think, right now, where we're having gentrification, and
I could have thrown that up there, too.
I was going to say, because,
especially with
there's like a serious housing problem in Portland, where the people that work in Portland can't live in Portland, so they've got to move out now to these rural areas. So that's a whole other dynamic. Again, the transportation thing that you brought up there earlier, you know, it's like people are now having to commute into Portland to work these, you know, lower paying jobs. I think that's a real problem also for rural areas.
It is, and gentrification is like
gentrification driving people to rural areas.
It is, and I mean I could have done a whole slide about that itself, like gentrification in rural areas. Don't hit me when I say this. I feel gentrification in rural areas is more of an epidemic than in metro areas.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's a problem in metro areas, don't get me wrong. But in rural areas, like the mall back in the 80s, like that was gentrification. And like, there's some small towns that will say, this town is not the same because of that mall. And it's true, like my town, Bergner's, JCPenney's, are out of business. We had a Kmart out of business. We have to rely on Walmart. Walmart and Walmart distribution right now. And Super Menards. Who grocery shops at a Menards? That's what I want to know. But this is what we do.
I'm very late to the seminar. Just got here. But have you already discussed like voter turnout in rural areas?
No. Okay. I'm going to not talk about that specifically, but I will get into that.
Okay, and what are you using as a definition of rural?
That's the first thing,
These are my definitions. Got it? There will be a test. Yes.
I know, like in District 31, we're close to Juneau County, and they're having a humongous problem with rural wells being contaminated with nitrites due to the runoff of Big A, right? And then you have high capacity wells that are pulling from rural wells, and not only are they being poisoned, but they don't have access to water. Then they have to pay $90,000 to re-drill. So I like. It's not just, I mean, we have to work on Big A. How do we do that? Because that seems to be the only way that farmers feel secure enough to continue operating their family farms when all they're doing is monocropping.
Yes, right? That's another big thing too, right? Because you have produce farmers that focus just on corn, just on soy, at least in the Midwest. You know, down south, we're going to do cotton, tobacco, all that great stuff, right? Which that itself, like, ruins the land. I mean, there are scientific studies that if you do monoculture crops, like, this is a problem for that land that you're on. That 17% of arable land of monoculture, right? And I've seen runoff problems as well, but it's like, what else are we going to do? I mean, this is what we have to do and everything. Because to tie in with that, like fracking's a big issue in rural areas. Like, again, back in Illinois, you have fracking, and they're fracking in southern Illinois near like our big state forest system, you know? And they're taking sand from a state park in a small town and shipping it down south for the fracking and everything, which I think they're also doing in Oconomowoc, the sand there, I want to say, they're fracking up there, or Menominee Falls, I think.
And over by us, too, they're tearing up our bluffs to take the silica sand to fracture, or hydraulic fracture in the Bakken fields and Alberta tar sands. But then we're, I just wanted to follow up with that. So people, the rural communities are looking at rights of nature, but farmers are afraid of that, and how do you bridge that gap?
I mean, at that point, it's just a conversation. I mean, it really has to be a conversation at that point, because as much as you want to support the farmer, I mean, these people live on these lands, and that runoff goes through certain neighborhoods. Like, I have a farm pond, but that farm pond is full of crop runoff. You know? And it's just, in their infinite wisdom, like, we had algae, and they threw Asian carp in there. Like, that was DNR's biggest light bulb. I'm like, what'd you do? Like, we threw his grass carp in there. I'm like, oh, I gotcha. I'm like, you can eat it. I'm like, I'm not eating that. But at that point, you have to have a conversation about that, because that will get into those cities' water systems, you know? And that gets into sanitation issues, that gets into drinking water issues, which, you know,
then people are dependent on Nestle for their water.
Yeah.
Right? Because
or
they're shipping it.
Or
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
These things are
not nice.
They are. Which goes to this. In rural areas, the communities that are affected. Now, this is not a complete list. Let me just say it. But this is the majority of the communities that are affected. Communities of color are affected in rural areas. Again, my town is 40% Latinx because of a racist approach. We had a steel mill. We were one of a few in the Midwest that were enclosed. If you go out east for steel mills, that kind of decentralized in Pittsburgh, right? Then it's here, then it's railed over here. Ours was all in-house. Okay. P.W. Dillon, in infinite wisdom, went to Mexico. Said, we'll give you a job. But you're only working in the furnace, because y'all can handle the heat. And on top of that, we're going to give you housing. And the housing was put in streetcars with silver lining on it, and they call that little area Silver City. So we have two generations of a Latinx community that was brought up on a hope and a prayer, really, to have a job, which they did, but they got paid less, had housing, which was substandard, and, you know, and they only live on one side of town. They're all redlined to the west end of town, which now people, because, well, that's the bad part of town, don't go down Griswold Avenue, even though my friend lives there, like, don't go there. I can't have rallies at the labor hall because that's on the bad part of town, but you can have it at the Elks Club on the east side of town. We'll go there. But it's like, but Dairy Queen's on the west side of town. I mean, y'all go to Dairy Queen. You want to go to Labor Hall? Women. Women are affected in rural communities because of lack of resources. 60%, well, again, in rural areas that I have lived in, Iowa, Illinois, and parts of Wisconsin, like, there's around 60% of women who are homeless. And they have, like, no housing, or they can't get the adequate shelter that they need and everything, yeah.
Don't it distract you too much, but what is the story? How do you have 60% homeless women? Are they fleeing domestic violence? Or are they?
So there is that part of they are fleeing domestic violence. Some are just transient, going from one town to another town, or they're single mothers. Like in my town, like, there are some women who were in a relationship, had a child, person left. And that's just that story I've seen and heard all the time, and going around to all these rural communities, that same story and everything. and they don't have the adequate health care they don't need, don't have the adequate child care they need, education, things of that nature, youth and young adults. There are no services for youth and young adults. Not a community center. Most rural areas will not even give you a skate park. If you play certain music, they'll say you can't play that. You gotta play this. You know, like those kind of arts things, we'll give you those kind of art things. Basically, just stay home is what that is. You know, don't loiter. Don't be mall rats. You know, don't do anything. This is a problem. The LGBTQ plus community, you know, we don't have resources. When I lived in my town, you could not say anything. You could not come out. It was, you went to the one guy's house that everybody knew, or you went to the bar. Those were your only two options. We didn't have Gay Straight Alliance in high school. We didn't have any services for youth. You know, we didn't have any of stuff. We didn't have Pride Parade. You know, and the working class. I think the jobs stuff I showed you earlier kind of shows that working class is affected in rural areas. So let's talk about representation from a campaign perspective. Less population means less constituents. Okay, if you're running for office at the state level, I'm talking about, and even parts of the even congressional level, but for state level purposes, less of the population means you have less constituents, right? Which means redistricting and gerrymandering is going to be a big thing in your district, and it's on purpose. This is no joke. Like that's a state district in Illinois. And it's centered between the Quad Cities, which is a major region area in the area, my town of 10,000 people, and then like this little farming community. And then everything else is rural. So if you're a candidate, Democrats and Republicans will do this all the time. They'll only pay attention to votes that count. They will not touch this. They may go to the farmer's market. They may shake hands at the, you know, AmVets or American Legion, right? They may kiss the pig at the county fair. Don't. Just don't. I mean, it's just not going to be pretty. But that's what happens in elections. They're gerrymandered in rural areas that are centered around major hubs or big, small towns, right? And they will not focus on the other stuff. So these are House districts in Iowa. So you might have like, this is like Des Moines right here. So you can kind of see a little bit of gerrymandering right in there in the big hubs. Iowa City, Cedar Rapids area, Quad Cities. But if you look at everything else, like all these are big chunks of rural land.
Wow.
And this is like the Iowa model of representation. I mean, it's better.
But isn't like your district supposed to be based on population and census data?
It is. No, it is. And you're right. It is based on your census data. Which gets into a population issue for rural areas. Because if people leave, then these change, right? Your census changes, right? Mm-hmm. So you're right, it does based on your census. However, if you're like Democrats, Republicans ruling the state, they can still say, well, we need this, we need that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we face in the Midwest. Like, Democrats in Illinois always have a say. on how they treat district. Iowan Democrats will say this is how it should be done. So, and it's also representation, you have like a metro-rural divide. In Illinois, we have Chicago and everything else. In Illinois, this is from Galena to here is called downstate. If you live in Chicago, they call it downstate everything else. And so you have like this big divide between Chicago, Springfield, where a capital is, and everyone else. So you have this divide when you have states like this, Iowa with Des Moines and everyone else, Indianapolis with Indy and everyone else, Michigan, Ann Arbor, and everyone else. So you have that. You also have regional divisions, like Colorado, which I love. This is why I love Colorado. You have Front Range issues, Plains issues, and Western Slope issues. And if you're ever in Colorado for a weekend, I highly encourage you to go to Public Access and listen to state legislation, because they will say that. Like, us on the Front Range want this. Us on the Western Slope want this. And it's important to listen to, because these are three separate issues in the same state. So if you look at Colorado, I mean, you pretty much have Colorado, you have Denver in the suburbs, and Colorado Springs. Everything else is rural. So you have mountain issues to deal with. You have plains issues to deal with. How many people have read this book? It's a great book. If you haven't, read it. This was the warning sign that Trump's America is going to happen. When Thomas Frank wrote this book, he really looked at why Kansas all of a sudden went Republican. Because Kansas for a while was mostly a Democratic state. Even had Republicans voting for Democratic Party issues. But Kansas at this time, and we're talking about like early 2000s, late 90s, that it flipped when that happened. So he posed the question, what's the matter with Kansas? And he kind of laid out a few things that, like, people weren't listening to the elected officials, weren't listening to constituents, so the elected officials, Republicans, listened to the constituents and went through their demands. If you go to Kansas now, it's pretty much a libertarian state, with Sam Brown back and all that. I wrote an article in Wisconsin during the Walker campaign. It's an independent voter network. And I didn't title it, What's the Matter with Wisconsin? It was, why did Scott Walker win during the recall? He won because he paid attention to Western Wisconsin and the Northland, Northwoods. Because if you go to Wisconsin, there are two big counties, Milwaukee County and Dane County, Madison. They draw in 45% of the state's income. Walker didn't care about that. He cared about what happened in Spooner, Wisconsin. He cared about people around Janesville. He cared about people in Veracruz. He listened to them. And those are the people he went to and won the vote. He even got certain counties went Democrat on the western side, flipping Republican. And that's why Scott Walker won the recall election, because he actually listened to that constituency. The Democratic Party never did that. They listened to Dane County and Milwaukee County. That's it. So where do Republicans and Democrats lose? Because there's got to be a loss here, right? They never listened to the working class. All right? I just said Scott Walker listened. He did. But he doesn't really listen. They didn't really listen to like the problems these towns have. The infrastructure, the education, et cetera, because we're seeing states like Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, Michigan, and Indiana, stripping away the education system, stripping away healthcare and everything else. Republicans and Democrats always lean to big ag, Monsanto, Bayer, ADM, et cetera, et cetera. They always focus on metro areas and not rural areas. Again, they'll visit, they'll come to the county fair, but they're getting money from the metro areas, and they vote in Republicans and Democrats to support their agenda. So in other words, they will get someone who's, you would think, not even winnable as a Republican and Democrat. And we've seen this. Like, why is this person even running? They are running because they are supporting their party's agenda. Because they want a safe bet. They want a safe bet in the state house. They want a safe bet in Congress. That's why this person that you know is not really social. He doesn't have no policy experience whatsoever. But Republicans and Democrats will throw money at them because they're a safe bet when it comes to their agenda in the state house and Congress or county board. So what's the big opportunity for us? Third-party candidates and organizing. I will bet you in most rural areas there's not a Green Party chapter, you know, not even a socialist chapter, you know. There's not even one. So there's this big vacuum in a town that just heard a Republican, just heard a Democrat voice. There is no other voice, right? So we need to fill Republican and Democrat. This is the void we need to fill, which is why we need to build chapters in rural areas. You know, try to get people to run for office, or at least show up to a meeting, you know? If we do that, like, the only reason why Indivisible's doing so well right now, because they're actually doing something. They're going to a city council meeting. They're standing on the street corner doing all that. That's why they're getting the attention. If we did the same thing, and I know people in this room are probably doing that, so I'm not discrediting what you guys are doing, but areas that I'm seeing, we're not doing that. So this is a big opportunity for us, for candidates. And if we also organize in these same areas, like, get like in my town, like, we're doing a racial justice campaign right now to address the racism that's going on in our town right now. We're also doing, like, books not bombs, doing a book drives and sending them to prisons. One of my friends is doing a female hygienics drive where people can donate female hygienic products and send them to shelters and prisons and everything. Those are the kind of level of organizing I'm talking about. Earlier someone talked about voting and everything. So the rural voter, these are your typical rural voters, mostly small business owners. And 90% of the time they're going to vote Republican because they want to keep their jobs. They want to keep their money. The culture of Republicanism has been conditioned in these areas. More for family and social values. These are the voters. Democratic candidates, they have to look anti-establishment. So I don't know what your guys is like, a big name person on a state level or anything, like, but for Illinois, like, you gotta be against Mike Madigan, who's the Speaker of the House. You know? So you have to, like, go, I'm not for Mike Madigan, so, you know, I will get a progressive tax in there and make sure Planned Parenthood's coming in. Like, yeah, that's the person I'm gonna vote for. Because they're anti-establishment. But once Republicans says, oh, but you donated money to Mike Madigan 10 years ago. This is your typical rural voter right here.
Okay, I'm not quite sure would you explain something a little more on that? So you're saying most of the rural voters are small business owners,
yes,
and they're Republicans.
They will vote Republican.
Largely by tradition.
Yes.
Yeah.
They hold certain sets of values that have attained the moniker of family,
yeah,
social, whatever. So I don't understand the fourth part.
This part?
Yeah. So you're saying that if someone is a rural, or someone running in a rural area,
as a Democrat,
who is running as a Democrat,
yes,
the Democrat has to say, I'm against
the
establishment.
Against.
But the establishment is Republican. So I don't understand. If you're saying.
Well, like for Illinois, for Illinois, it's like a Democratic state. Same with Iowa, and I mean, I'm just throwing this in there. If your state also has a Democratic Party, large Democratic Party presence. That's what I'm saying. I would even go further than that. Some Democratic candidates will even shift their focus to Republican values as well. If they're in a Republican county, they will even say, like, well, I am more Republican than everything else that way.
What would you say is voter participation in these areas?
Low.
Very low.
Low.
Or low? Okay.
And it's by precinct that matters, but like in general, we're talking low turnout. Some counties I've seen like a couple of thousand.
So we have real opportunities there then. I mean, if we're just trying to, you know, there's a like with lower turnout, we go in there and we get more people to, you know, we have a better chance of winning in a lower turnout,
right,
area.
Correct.
Well, what is this in terms of percentages? Like, just say, for example, overall in a presidential election.
In a presidential election?
It's like you get, overall, it's like 62 to 65% somewhere will vote in a presidential election,
yeah,
across the United States. So what is it in rural areas?
So the rural areas that I know of, like, 20-30% will turn out. And that's still big. For a town like 10,000 people, that might be big. I mean, that's just a fact, and that's because people are working. You have that late night voter, I call the 11th hour voter, in a small town, like they're working all day and have to rush to get their vote in. And sometimes polling places are not even close by. They do. Or, like my polling place, we have 3 precincts in 1 polling place. That's in a mental health facility. And I have to walk through the work area where all these adult clients have to work. Yeah.
So, you know, you talked about how we need to really fill that gap and like work,
yeah,
on these rural municipal committees.
Yeah.
Now, if voter engagement is very low, voter participation is really low, what's your idea of going into there to get those municipal, get people activated so they start going to that municipal committee, and then we could potentially start winning elections in those areas?
Well,
how do you get them from not really wanting to participate in politics,
right,
to
participating, because it's in their best interest. It is, you
it
know,
is.
All those issues that we can help them with.
So I'm a big believer in organizing, then getting the vote. Because I feel this is the way to engage people.
Organizing around issues.
Around issues or a project. My town, I'm working with faith leaders. Like, we have 20 churches in my town. And I'm working with progressive faith leaders on this racial justice project.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
So I'm talking to congregants, right? I'm talking to kids that come through, you know? I'm using their space to talk about white privilege and racism and stuff like that, doing anti-oppression training in these spaces. So I'm trying to activate them that way. And I'm saying, well, aren't you also the Green Party? Oh yeah, here, get my vote.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm a big believer in you have to organize in order to get your vote. Because that's the only way we're going to engage. I feel we can't engage by running general election, consolidated elections, whatever you call it, and be that perpetual candidate. Because if you're not out there in the neighborhood, if you're not out there at the public meeting, if you're not writing letters to the editor or whatever the case is, if you're not doing that to be engaged and so other people can be with you, you're not going to get the vote. You're just simply not. I'll get to you. Organizations, we were talking about this earlier. These are the organizations that will somewhat dictate how people will also vote, as well as having say in your town. So the not-for-profit industrial complex, Chamber of Commerce, United Way, certain community partnerships, like they know people, they're the ones who will put someone in the mayor's office, they will put someone in city council, they will push for something. Churches, I mean, this is no joke, like you, there are certain Baptist churches that will give someone a platform, certain Lutheran churches will give someone a platform, Presbyterian churches, Catholic churches. Economic development will simply tell people, it's like, well, we really can't have geothermal because from our studies, it's not feasible. We really can't have public broadband because we're telling you we can't do it. You know? Anchor businesses. If you have a business that started in your town, how many people have heard of Wall Clipper?
What is it?
Wall Clipper. They do hair clippers. They're made in my town. Well, they're in my town, made in China, and then assembled in my town. So let's get that straight. So, but they're an anchor business. And they have big say as to what goes on in town. Like right now they're talking to people in China.
Wow.
And working with a big partnership between China and our town. The mill I talked about earlier, that had big influence. Like every year it's like, we're gonna move to Kentucky if you don't give us a tax break. So we give them a tax break, you know? And active political organizations. Right now in my town, we have a growing Libertarian Party in my area. And they're growing because they're active. They're doing the parades. They are doing meet and greets. They are meeting people at Culver's right now, you know? So we've had more people vote for Gary Johnson last time around because they were active.
What's the awareness of people living in the rural communities about the effect of free trade on their communities?
Oh, that's a big problem. I mean, that's a huge factor. I mean, I talked about job growth before. If you have like an anchor business that's really successful and big, then, you know, that's always a conversation about free trade. Like, this is a problem, so you have to vote this person in order for us to be more successful. Otherwise, we'll leave town. So, let's say if after all this you want to run for office in a rural area, you want to get laid land. Check to see what government entities exist in your area. So if you live in a rural area, more likely you're going to have state race, county board, city race. You can be part of a congressional district, maybe a village board. Research through your clerk's office on voting history, especially if you're a new chapter in your area. Call the clerk's office and look at right there at the office and see in the voting history in your precinct or in your county. You know, has it changed from Democrat to Republican? Has it gone from Republican to Democrat? If so, what's those significant numbers? Look for unique opportunities for each office. And I can't stress that enough. Because there's going to be that one office that's so unique that it might be crazy enough for you to win. In my state, there's a county coroner. they declare the person dead. They're the only position in Illinois that can arrest the sheriff.
Right, but how many people have the skill to be a coroner?
Well, but it's the thing, you don't have to have that skill.
Oh.
Because you have to just get trained. They give you a kit, you know? But the but the important, they do, it's all it is. It's a needle, wow. It's a needle this long, and then
wow.
You take it to someone who does the autopsy. That's all you do. But you're the official person that says, dead. But the latter part you should have been listening to, they arrest the sheriff. And that's a huge thing. When I thought about running for a county coroner in my town, not because I want to pronounce people dead, that I thought this was an opportunity to say that I will arrest this sheriff, who's a Republican, who more often than not will put people of color in my county in jail or arrest somebody. And that's a huge opportunity. And if you're especially pro Black Lives Matter, this is a huge opportunity for that as well. Don't discount community colleges in rural areas. Most community college districts are about the same size as a state senate district. So my community college incorporates 9 counties. So think about that. It incorporates 9 counties, which is the same as the same state senate district I'm also in. And it's a 6-year term. Excuse me, 4-year term. So think about this. You run and win community college and you're under for 4 years. And another 4 years, you have 8 years. You're pretty much running on the equivalent level of a state senate level. And you're dealing with education, you're dealing with agriculture, you're dealing with job growth, you're dealing with poverty, you're dealing with all these other issues I just talked about before on a community college board, because that's your bread and butter is a community college district. That you need education, but you want innovation in business, you want innovation from agriculture. Maybe you want to be that one board member to have an alternative energies institute, to have the windmill out front, to make your roof green.
So I like to say lay of the land is important. I agree with you. But checking to see government entities that exist in your area aren't limited to U.S. government agencies and entities.
True.
Within Wisconsin and Minnesota, right, upper Midwest, we have 11 tribal nations.
Yes.
In each state, that's 22 tribal nations, right, in 2 states. We're predominantly overlooked, right?
We yes.
are maybe 1-2% of the U.S. population, but where do we live? We are in rural areas. Our reservations are in rural areas. And not only that, but we have inalienable rights, right? We have rights that supersede the average U.S. citizen that protect you all and our rural communities,
yeah.
But we are completely overlooked. And I would like to use the quote, twice invisible.
Yes.
Because when you looked at the 1.5 million children that live in poverty, when you broke it down, where was your Native American statistic?
And I'll be honest, I couldn't even find that statistic outside of the Bureau in its
yeah,
affairs.
Yeah, they will leave it to you.
So, and I should apologize for not including that because that is important.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it is.
Not just the Midwest, but out west.
Your entire United States.
Right? So I do apologize for not including all that because that is.
Because that's a big.
It is.
Government body to have.
And I gotta be honest, I didn't know how to quite address that in a mm-hmm. in a campaign context. Because, and I'm going to throw the question to you, how does one run for office knowing there's a reservation in your district? And how does one approach a reservation or even address that you have, even on a congressional level, like you have BIA,
uh-huh.
who doesn't give grant money to any reservations or anything? Outside of that,
so how would you contact your local government? A phone call, right?
Yeah.
Or you stop into the government office. We're human beings like anyone else.
Yeah.
And you would approach us the same way, right? You don't go into your state governor's office and expect to speak to the governor, right? You speak to the secretary. You figure out the avenue in which to approach the appropriate body, and they will guide you through that. But the problem is we've been together for 500 plus years. We don't know how to interact with each other within the political realm, let alone the social realm. And if we disenfranchise a population that historically does not vote because we're not represented within the political realm, the Green Party is missing out on a humongous voter block.
One more question. No, because I just want to know.
Yeah.
Because I've always been told this.
Okay.
I can't go on tribal land.
Who told you that?
People in the reservation.
It's not. So tribal land is not sovereign.
Right.
So we are sovereign nations without a land mass.
Right.
Belonging entirely to us because the U.S. government still sees us as wards of the state and they mandate that our land masses are held in trust with the federal government.
Correct.
For better or for worse, right? And I would lean towards the latter.
Right. Always a latter.
Right, right. But when you think about that, that means it's federal trust land. Nothing would prevent a U.S. citizen from going onto reservation land unless they were breaking the law. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. So not only do we have to check our state legislation, our federal register, but then if you are planning on traveling to a reservation, why not check out their website and see what laws are out there that might be different? And if you call their office, they'll let you know, oh, we run on the same, you know, we don't have anything special. Some tribal nations don't even have their own police force. Right, they rely on the predominantly white communities to service their areas, and it's not the local police departments. It would be this, not even state, it would be federal. We don't. So a lot of times you'll see a police officer is trying to come onto
right.
the reservation land. The reason why they can't arrest is because they have no jurisdiction.
Right.
Because we're in federal trust.
Correct.
Right.
Right.
And so it's a fallacy. And maybe that's just because people who have less power try and find any way to hold on to it, right? And that's the same with any population, whether that be the LGBTQI plus
yes.
community,
yes.
the communities that have different ability levels. But I really think, especially in the upper Midwest, if we don't capitalize on people who would be supportive of the Green Party platform, because where's our indigenous stance in the platform, right? Democrats won't do it, Republicans won't do it, and are there any other parties that exist or are viable to do what we in tribal communities need? Right? Because a lot of these issues impacting rural areas will be protected if we adhere to treaty rights and our senators and our representatives are aware because they're codified within Article 6, Section 2 of our U.S. Constitution. So our sovereignty relies on respecting other sovereignty and maintaining, as U.S. citizens, their participation within the political process.
And I want to make this a teachable moment because, no, seriously, because again, what you're seeing is ignorance because of the education that I personally receive to give you the information I'm providing you. So I thank you for addressing that because that's always been a question I've always had and didn't know really how to address it outside of like, who do I know who's indigenous, you know, because you're right, there are tribal lands that are in these political lines, and again, as someone who was told many years ago, like, I could not go on land to talk about politics, because for the obvious reason, that I don't know how to approach that other than saying, you got to be the candidate to be supporting.
Right. But you'd approach that community just like any other, right? You don't go into Arcadia, Wisconsin expecting to love you just because you showed up and knocked on a few doors, right? You better go to their community organizations, right? And natives have that. We're just like any human society, and we need to utilize the internet at our fingertips to gain knowledge so that we can apply it in an equitable way.
Can you hold that one moment?
Sure.
We're a little past five. No.
It's a follow-up.
Don't say sorry. Do not say sorry.
It's a follow-up on her.
Okay. I just want to bang through these really quick. So land, you want to run for office. This is the kind of campaign team if you're going to run, especially if you're like in a rural area. It may be a small team. You may have a small campaign staff. You probably have to meet weekly because of how small you are. And yet they have key campaign teams. And these are the suggested staff positions. paid or not, that you should have.
Mm-hmm.
Let me emphasize that, paid or not, to have right here. If you're going to organize, go around your area and see what is happening or what are those voids I talked about earlier. Attend community events, organizations, and local partnerships like a food co-op or a grassroots organization. If you're going to do organizing, then again, it might be a large to small team depending on the issue. Again, the weekly meetings, while striving towards monthly meetings. And these are the suggested campaign teams, which probably be the exact same thing as a political team. So the commonalities of campaign activities, whether it's a political campaign or organizing, have a house party, you know, be in someone's house, you know, with food. It's a very intimate time to talk with somebody. Speak at events and meetings. Your library always has a room available, you know. Your Kiwanis always wants to have someone talk. Schools need someone to talk. Endorsements, you need to get endorsements from churches, the key person, whomever. Build a database for your campaign, whether it's Nation Builder or using Excel. You got to build a database. You know, you got to have that information in order to know what works, what doesn't. Story-focused campaign. Always have a story campaign. Pay attention to the narrative. You make reform and you get the vote by the narrative. Okay? Base building for local movements. If you have a local movement, build that base to make it bigger, stronger, and badass. One-on-one organizing. A lot of churches do this and a lot of other community organizing networks do this. It's a really great method. And one-on-one, just as it is, like, I'm just getting to know Justin. Talk, how you doing, how's the family, you know, kids are fine, you know, and then hopefully we meet 2 weeks from now or something like that to still build that and go with someone else.
By narrative, you mean by stay on message or something?
Stay on message and what, like with the organizing,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to use Flint as example. Yes, Flint is about poor water quality, right? But Flint became big by seeing someone's house and seeing water coming out of that faucet. You know, they saw it in the school. They saw it in the public park. That's what I mean by a story, the narrative and everything. Stick to that, not just the message, but what the real issue is and everything. And canvassing, you know, always canvass. You know, the petitioning, going door to door. That's all I have. Any questions over here?
Is it possible to get a copy of your slides?
Yes.
They're incredibly helpful. My goodness.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. I was really panicking because this was like the one workshop I thought I was like, do I have enough information?
So, I'm fortunate enough, by the way, Michael White, Wisconsin, candidate for governor. I'm fortunate enough to have Erin in my corner of the state and listen to her when she said, you really ought to come to the powwow. And so I went to the Ho-Chunk Nation powwow and spent a whole day out in the sun canvassing. It was extremely productive. What I have not been successful enough afterwards is following up, because I thought I had good contact information for a lot of people, and I found out I didn't. But I think that the message that she gives, reach out to those people. So how many people have heard of Pine Ridge? Okay, a number of people haven't. But Bobby Kennedy went there, and most of the country didn't even know what it was. And he went there because he made a point of caring about first people's interests and issues when nobody else was paying attention. He actually made it a Senate issue. And making their issues your issues because they're the right thing to do, as opposed to you just want to reach out for votes, that's the way to get the context.
That's absolutely correct, because any organizing I do, it's not about me. It's about, it's really about the issue and the front line that I'm working with. It's not the AJ show. It's not AJ's nonprofit, you know, it's how can I help? You know, I'm just in the background. You know, I'm in solidarity with that group. And I think sometimes we do sometimes get ahead of ourselves and try to get the vote and be ourselves, but it's like, no, it's about the issue and what affects, say, Wisconsin, what affects your U.S. Senate district, what affects Maine. So that's what it's really about. You have a question?
Well, yeah. You know, I was wondering, again, talking about like indigenous people, you know, I was wondering, like, first of all, is the Census Bureau, is it, you know, do they do a good job of capturing, like, the people on the reservations? And so that could lead to problems with gerrymandering and things like that. But also, you know, is it just that we're not getting our candidates known to the indigenous community so that they know that there is somebody that is actually good to vote for? And they're just seeing Democrats and Republicans, and that, like, so they're not interested in participating in that system. But if they actually had a candidate from the Green Party, you know, that is outside of that system, maybe they would actually participate more. Is that what you're finding?
So if you look at what in the 2016 election, right? What did the Democratic Party do? They said, we are all about indigenous rights. They found an indigenous spokesperson, but really what they did is tokenized.
Yeah.
Right? Because where's the follow-through still in Congress today? We were a forethought then when they needed something from us, just like the federal government and their extreme extraction intentions, right? But when they are in office, in Congress, in our legislatures, who's our advocate, right? Who's fighting for cultural preservation, making sure that the United States is adhering to UNDRIP. And if you don't know what UNDRIP is, educate yourself, because UNDRIP is imperative as long as we're still a part of the UN. And that's the UN's Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, right? If you are concerned about the ICE issues, recognize that people that are from South America are indigenous Americans, just like the Native Americans here that are indigenous within the United States. We are one people separated by colonial states. Power, hungry, greedy for power, right? And so where do we lie within the political realm other than a tokenized campaign piece? And I think that's where the Green Party can stand apart from everyone else and seize an opportunity that no one else is recognizing because we have blinders on, because of what we're taught within the education systems, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes.
How many people know MMIW? I've heard of it. What is it?
Murdered, missing indigenous women.
Oh,
and that's where your census data, they don't even know how many of us are missing in the United States. You know, and then that plays into how many children are actually missing in the United States that are refugees seeking asylum with their parents. It's an intersectional problem targeted at not only brown women and children, black women and children, right? Poor white women and children. This is an intersectional issue, but we have statistics on the black communities, we have statistics on the white communities, but what about the Native American community?
Does Bureau of Indian Affairs have that information also, or no?
They don't track it, and they won't until somebody pressures our government to do so. The only reason Canada has a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that's addressing MMIW is because the UN threatened to sanction them.
Really?
Yes. Yep. Yep.
That part I didn't know.
Yep. But just recently, Trudeau bought TransCanada Pipeline, nationalized oil production, and who knows what's going to happen from there. I mean, it's a North American issue that isn't, I mean, the U.S. isn't the only one doing this, right? But can we do better? Absolutely.
It's like I've always said, America's tip of Alaska to the bottom of Argentina.
Yes, sir.
Not just this one land we call the United States.
Yeah.
Well put.
Yeah, if anyone's interested, I'm going to check that out, because like when I go home, I'm actually going to go into a rally for that. Because I just found out before I got here, like three women from the reservation in Iowa were taken. So it goes back to what you're talking about. You said earlier about police.
Yeah.
Like, well, police will, my understanding is like the police will wait until they come off reservation land and then kidnap them. That's been my understanding of how that worked.
Being raised, I was always taught if you're alone and you see a police officer, you run. If you see a state agent, you run.
That should be everyone.
Right? Yeah. But like, yeah. And the foster care system is complicit in MMIW, just so you know.
What?
The foster care system.
They're complicit about it?
Yeah. They steal kids unnecessarily from indigenous families, violating our indigenous rights, perpetuating indigenous genocide, because the state gives 90,000, no, 50,000 and 90,000 per foster child per group home. And a lot of times these children go missing because nobody gives, you know, a you know what about us. The majority of the time, it's overlooked. Right? Twice invisible.
Yeah.
So you're telling me that they're kidnapped, essentially, and put in foster homes for profit.
Yes,
absolutely.
And Wisconsin has made strides to overcome that with, there's a federal mandate called ICWA, which is child services, right?
Right.
But WICWA kind of helped with that a bit, but we're seeing with our current governor and our current federal administration that there are rollbacks that are going to impact us. And keep in mind, Native communities are regulated under the Department of Department of Interior, but Department of Agriculture, and we are the only human beings tracked like cattle. And I'll give you my internment camp number. I'll show it all to you guys. It's not tattooed on my skin, but I gotta carry it on me to maintain my sovereignty in the ISIC. So, I'm running for Senate in Wisconsin. Look me up on my line.
Any other questions? Thank you for all attending, I know. It's not a sexy issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, boy.
I think I'm late for something.
Yeah, thank you for running and doing your part. It sounds like
that's enough. Let me tell you, because I have two day jobs, but I can't do
it. That's why we're all here, I think. Well, wouldn't it be wonderful to have her there? When you're both of you. You know, and that's the thing, you know, I think, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of incorruptibles. They do it more on a municipal level, where it's like they want to push a slate of progressive candidates, not necessarily looking at party, because it's, you know, nonpartisan races usually at the municipal level. And really get them, like, flood the whole city council.
They did good.
Yeah.
I was at Dave Koch thing, and we came for part of it, but my smarter partner was here for the whole time.
And how was the David Koch?
Well, Jill wasn't there because the flight was delayed. There's going to be a